resumption of the Portfolio Committee on Police. Also welcome to Judge Schomo and his team from the Independent Judge Office, and as well as Judge Mufaro from the DNA Board. Maybe members, maybe members just in terms of our program for the rest of the week, I just want to give members feedback. Members will remember that we were destined to get a CI in terms of the report back, but due to the strategic planning session of SAPS, we are going to shift that to Friday morning. So we will get the Minister of Police will also come to the committee on Friday, so I just want to give early notice to members on that. In terms of today, we're going to have the presentation first from the DPCI judge and his delegation. I think the report was tabled yesterday, and it's reflected this morning in the ATC, so they made it on time. So you officially hear. In terms of the report of the DNA board, we will deal with that when we come to that item. But you are very welcome. We also got an apology from the Secretary of Police because I have requested him to be present because of the issues we're going to raise in terms of the DNA board, but Advocate Chief Director from the Secretariat is here, welcome to as well. Then colleagues, tomorrow, colleagues will remember we still need the presentation from DPCI regarding the two units, the firearms unit as well as the drugs unit, so they will give that presentation tomorrow. But then members will remember the issues came up during our interaction with DPCI with regard to the Western Cape. There's two issues. The one deals with the progress in terms of the disciplinary cases with regard to the firearms that were stolen at the two police stations, but there was also indication by national police management that there's an audit underway in the Western Cape regarding firearms, so we will also get a report on that tomorrow. And then traditionally at this time of the year, we will get an update on the festival season program of SAPS in terms of their preparations. So that will be the third item on our program tomorrow. And then on Friday, the Minister of Police will come to the committee to address the issues in terms of CI, but also CI still needs to give to the committee a written report on the issues we've raised during the last meeting. There is a presentation that was made available to us, but that's our program for the week.
I want to raise it for the attention of the committee, and it's actually about this building that we're in. This is the first time this morning that I've seen an officer at the members' entrance for a very long time. The bar doesn't work, and I'm highlighting this because a number of Democratic Alliance MPs' offices have been broken into. Some have been trashed completely. There are other members on committees who are being followed, cars broken into, just nothing stolen, just all the doors left open, the handbrake released. Very strange things are happening. And I think the police committee needs to be very aware of that, and I would hate to think that at any stage the police who are supposed to be investigating these entities might have to go up against another government entity. So very strange things going on, and as I say, that is just from my knowledge of my party. I don't know if this is happening at all to other parties or anyone else, perhaps in this building or elsewhere. So I thought I should just put it out there for this, so that everyone in this committee knows what's going on in this building and perhaps elsewhere right now. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we note that. Of course, that is a matter for the Chief Whip's Forum and, of course, the Speaker as the executive authority of the National Assembly and, of course, the Chairperson of the HOB. But I think we note it, and if need be, we will take it forward. Thank you. Right, members, I'm going to first ask the honourable members to introduce themselves, and then I'll ask Judge Cormor to introduce his delegation.
Melang Mahaitso, Lina Lagatina in Sumulevansi, the local committee.
Good morning, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, Sanwanani. I'm Zakele Mbele, member of the committee.
Tolibuwa mchemiza mshumo, ina langa nima vijari wani, mrado wa komiti ya chipulisa, Tolibuwa.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Pindi Lemola, a member of this portfolio committee. I thank you.
I'm Diane Colabano, also a member of the committee.
I'm Philip Mshangwa, a member of the committee.
Thank you very much. There's one or two apologies I think we received from members. The secretary has noted that. Just call more over to you. If you can maybe introduce your delegation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'm Franz Diagne-Pomo, DPCI judge. To my immediate right is Mr. Edward Rasiwila. He's the chief investigator in my office. And the gentleman there is Mr. Meseja Mutibe. He's a senior investigator. And Bongiwe Masilani, she's based in our office in Cape Town. She's managing the office, and she is my PD in this office. May I just say that we also have Ruth Majosi. She's managing the office in Pretoria. We left her to do that piece for us. And that is our full compliment, Chairperson and members.
Thank you very much, Josh Kumo, for the introduction. Maybe again, just to indicate from the committee side, the institution of the DPCI judge is very important. It's part of the oversight mechanisms in the country to ensure there's accountability from the police, specifically the DPCI. I think Judge Homo has, even since he started, he's been visiting offices around the country and is focusing on ensuring that DPCI is held to account. So we are looking forward to this interaction. You're welcome to go ahead with the presentation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Having introduced ourselves, I'm glad to report that this is the fifth report of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation to Parliament in compliance with Section 17L of the South African Police Service Act 68 of 1995. This report is belated due to the sad passing on of my predecessor, Judge Esa Musa, on the 26th of February of this year. And may I say, may his soul rest in peace. I was appointed on the 6th of October 2017 by the Honorable Minister of Police, Balula, after consultation with the Honorable Minister of Justice and Correctional Services and the Chief Justice of the Republic of South Africa. This annual report covers the period 1st April 2016 to the 31st of March 2017 during the tenure of my late brother, who laid a solid foundation for us to build on. We express our gratitude for the indulgence Chairperson accorded to us to brief the portfolio committee only at this late stage. The form of our presentation would be as follows. First, I will make a brief introduction pertaining to our vision, mission, objectives, values, and give a succinct overview of the performance of the DPCI Judge's Office for the year under review. And second, my intervention will be followed by a PowerPoint presentation by the Chief Investigator, Mr. Rasiwila. And then third, Chairperson, it will be then over to you to require from us whatever you deem necessary. Now, as to our mission, to achieve our vision, our mission is firstly to execute a civilian oversight role akin to the quintessential ombudsman in respect of investigations conducted by the DPCI, this is the HAWKS. Second, to promote and protect the basic human rights of members of the public generally, and on occasion, but more pertinently, to vindicate those whose constitutional rights may have been violated. Third, to secure and safeguard members of the HAWKS against improper influence or interference, whether of a political or any other nature, exerted upon them regarding the conducting of an investigation. And lastly, to create an environment in which the HAWKS can conduct their investigation without fear, favor, or prejudice. Now, as to our objective, the objective of the Office of the DPCI Judge is to maximize the integrity of the investigations conducted by the HAWKS and safeguard their independence from improper influence or interference, politically or otherwise. Allow me, Chairperson, to pause at what is meant by independence, by a specialized investigative unit directory like the HAWKS. The Constitutional Court in the Glenista matter had this to say about independence of the HAWKS. Independence primarily means that the anti-corruption bodies should be shielded from undue interference. To this end, genuine political will to fight corruption is the key prerequisite. Such political will must be embedded in a comprehensive anti-corruption strategy. The level of independence can vary according to specific needs and conditions. Experience suggests that it is the structural and operational autonomy that is important, along with a clear legal basis and mandate of a special body, department, or unit. This is particularly important for law enforcement bodies. Transparent procedures for appointment and removal of the director, together with proper human resource management and internal controls, are important elements to prevent undue interference. This is as regards the objectives of the Chairperson. And as regards the values, briefly, the values that we subscribe to are those of freedom, equality, human dignity, accountability, transparency, impartiality, and, as we reiterate, independence. If I may refer briefly to ourselves, Chairperson, not much has been written about the DPCI judge. What I could find is what Chief Justice Sandile Ngcobo has said about us in the Glenista case that is to be found in paragraph 147. What the Honorable Chief Justice is the following. Finally, there is judicial oversight to prevent undue interference which may result in criminal sanctions. In order to address any undue political influence with the functioning of the DPCI, Section 17L1 makes provision for the appointment of a retired judge to investigate complaints. These complaints include complaints of, quote, any improper influence or interference, whether of political or any other nature, exerted upon regarding the conduct of an investigation. In addition, the head of the directorate may, of his or her own accord, request the retired judge to investigate complaints or allegations relating to the investigations by the directorate or alleged interference with such investigation. This is an important legal mechanism to address undue political interference in the investigation. Now, Chairperson, this was said and agreed to by the Chief Justice in a minority judgment. In the same judgment, the majority judgment, Moseneke DCJ, Deputy Chief Justice, and Cameron J. had this certain reservations on some of the aspects that could have been improved upon. But what they say at paragraph 246 is briefly this. The complaints mechanism, headed by a retired judge and backed up by power to refer a complaint for prosecution, operates after the fact. It permits complaints to be made, but does not constitute a hedge in advance against their causes. It also permits a member of the public to complain about infringement of rights caused by an investigation, and permits, quote, any member of the directorate who can provide evidence of any improper influence or interference, whether of a political or any other nature exerted upon them, or her regarding the conducting of an investigation to complain. And if I could conclude with paragraph 247, this is relating to the judgment itself, Chairperson, is the judge says, this, in our respective view, deals with history. It does not constitute an effective hedge against interference. What is more, section 17L7 is clear that in the course of this investigation, the retired judge may request information from the National Director of Public Prosecution, insofar as may be necessary. But the NDPP may, on, quote, reasonable grounds, close quote, refuse to accede to such request. That may place a considerable hurdle in the way of the retired judge's investigation. In short, an ex post facto review, rather than insisting on a structure that an up initio prevents interference, has, in our view, serious and obvious limitations. In some cases, irreparable harm may have been caused which judicial review and complaints can do little to remedy. More importantly, and many acts of interference may go undetected or unreported and never reach a judicial review or complaint stage. Only adequate mechanism designed to prevent interference in the first place would ensure that this never happens. Close quote. That's as far as the judgment goes in the Minister. Chairperson, my predecessor had some concerns which I came across, and I look just to the main concerns. The first is that the DPCI judge's office, as a statutory body, lacks enforcement powers, and these are his words. Unlike a constitutional structure whose recommendations are enforceable if its findings and recommendations are not challenged on review. Close quote of what he has said. My colleague evidently had in mind the case of the Economic Freedom Fighters and another versus the Speaker and of the National Assembly and others. This is as regards the powers of the public protector. And Chairperson, we are not the Chapter 9 institution. His second concern is that the office of the DPCI judge lacks, quote, original powers to institute an investigation without receiving a formal complaint from a complainant, whether it be a member of the public or a member of the courts. Close quote. In short, what my late brother has said is that we are somehow debarred or inhibited from acting proactively in this regard. His third concern, which I wish to bring to the attention of this honorable committee, is that, and I quote, that the law seems to unfairly place an onus on the complainant to produce evidence in the case of members of the public of a serious and unlawful infringement of his or her rights caused by the Hawks, and in the case of members of the Hawks, of any improper influence or interference, whether of a political or any other nature, exerted upon him or her. Close quote. Now here, Chairperson, in my view, perhaps, the approach of the DPCI judge, as I see it, should be to remedy this perceived shortcoming or to allay this fear, ought to be that when the complaint hits our desk, to look at it and to investigate and not to really require the complainant to produce the entire evidence. Otherwise, this may not be quite what the Act envisages, and this Chairperson, I may say, would then mean we don't have anything to investigate, so we can act proactively in this regard. And lastly, I think of the concerns expressed by my late brother, and this is a primary concern, is that, and I agree, is that the office of the DPCI judge lacks capacity. Pursuant to this expressed concern, a memorandum was drafted and submitted to the civilian secretariat. This is before my time, Chairperson, of course. For police, Mr. A.P. Rabea, who remarked that relating to that submission to him, and I quote, "In principle, I support the creation of the new post. I don't have the authority to approve additional posts. This is the minister's area of authority. The inputs must be factored in the work of the task team dealing with organizational structure, which will be approved by the minister," and I close Mr. Rafinha's quote. In my view, additionally, this is now my own view, Chairperson, but foremost is that the entry level at which the investigators have been appointed is extremely low. Mr. Edward Rasiwila, who is doing an excellent piece of job, is a deputy director at level 11 only. Level 11. And his assistant, the assistant director, Mr. Messager, has been appointed at level 10 only. This must be juxtaposed with who they might investigate and the type of cases that DPCI, this is the Hawks, specializing in. And then as to what the DPCI is, one may want to look at the Supreme Court of Appeals case. This is in Vanessa versus the Helen Sussman Foundation. In particular, Chairperson, paragraphs 2 to 7, and then one can then look also at paragraph 47. I'm not going to quote them except just this line in paragraph 47, where the Honorable Mohammed Nasser says that there is a public interest and a crucial place that the DPCI enjoys in our democracy. Now, maybe just to pause a little, it's also a question of legitimacy. If this junior officer, who members of the party complain, it may be a complaint against a senior member of the Hawks, a general or a cabinet minister or even the higher office. And now this junior officer in my office has to investigate them. Of course I have to be there, but also the disparity between myself and themselves. Being there, well, I have to be hands-on, but to have these people who are doing a good job appointed as such does not legitimacy, and I think would erode public perception. I continue, Chairperson, and I'm almost there before the PowerPoint. The office of the DPCI judge must therefore be empowered in its oversight role and must engender confidence in the eyes of the general public. Judge Musa considered that Section 17L of the SAPS Act ought to be amended to cater for the above listed deficits or shortcomings. In my view, this aspect must be held in abeyance to make a comparative study, this is the amendment of the Act, to make a comparative study with Chapter 9 institutions, as I said, which we are not one of and we don't claim to be one and we don't say we have to be one, and seek a legal opinion by senior counsel if needed. The minister must also still be properly briefed in this regard. I would like to convey, Chairperson, my gratitude to the staff of the Office of the DPCI Judge for the hard work done thus far with limited resources, and also thank the civilian Secretariat of Police for the administrative support it continues to provide to this office. Permit me now, Chairperson, to hand over to Mr. Edward Rasiwila to make a PowerPoint presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge Fogo. You're welcome, sir. Thank you very much, Judge.
the Honorable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Police, the Honorable Members of the Committee, in the interest of time, all protocol observed. I'm going to give the overview performance of the Office of the DPCI Judge for the period 2016-2017. Before I go to the presentation, I would like to outline the areas in which the Office of the DPCI Judge performance is assessed or measured. We've got various areas in which the performance of the office is assessed. The first area of assessment, it deals with the case management system. That is the process of receiving complaints and the turnaround time of registering such complaint. That is the first area of assessment. The second one, it deals with the marketing of the office, which is about the public awareness campaigns and the stakeholder engagement or stakeholder meetings. The performance indicator there to measure the performance of the office is the number of the public awareness campaigns conducted per annum. Whether the office of the DPCI judge reached the target to conduct those awareness campaigns. And thirdly is the performance management. That is an administrative matter which the office of the DPCI judge is required to comply and to be accountable internal in terms of submitting the required reports and submitting the required documents. The other area in which the performance of the office is assessed is the investigation of complaints. This is the core function of the office of the DPCI judge. So the assessment for the performance of the office is with regard to the number of the complaints that which we finalized, depending on the number of the complaints received. So when you measure the office of the DPCI judge, you measure how many complaints were finalized during the period under review, depending on the number of the complaints that which were registered. Of course, we do have complaints that which are falling within the scope of our mandate. There is a target in terms of finalizing such complaints. And also, we also receive complaints that which are not falling within the scope of our mandate. We also have a target how to turn around time to finalize such complaints. Those are the areas in which the performance of the office is being measured. Now I will go to the PowerPoint presentation. Starting on page 3.
Yes, so you can maybe skip that or the next one because I think the judge already followed with that in his introduction. Thank you.
I can briefly touch on page 5, which is the operational budget of the Office of the DPCI Judge. During the period under review, the Office of the DPCI Judge was allocated 5,960,000. And on that amount, the office spent 5,215,548. And the balance was 744,452. That is the overall expenditure for the budget. I will move to the next slide, which deals with the question of case management system. The case management system is a system of capturing cases. registering cases that which we receive from the members of the public. During the period under review, the office received a total of 69 complaints. Out of 69 complaints, 31 were complaints which were falling within the scope of our mandate. In other words, these complaints were reported falling under Section 17L 4A and 4B. 4A are the complaints that which are from the members of the public who complain that their rights were unlawfully violated by members of the Hawks during the investigation. And 4B are the complaints from members of the Hawks who complain that there are interference or improper influence on their investigation. And then a total of 38 complaints were complaints which were falling outside the scope of our mandate. In other words, these complaints, there was no involvement of the Hawks, and as such, those complaints were falling outside the scope of our mandate. From the 31 complaints received, which were falling within the scope of our mandate, 29 complaints were complaints from members of the public in terms of Section 17L 4A of SAPS Act. And the 2 complaints were complaints from the members of the Hawks, which were received in terms of Section 17L B of SAPS Act. The performance indicator in terms of this area of case management is that whenever we receive a complaint, the target is that the complaint must be registered within 72 hours, that is 3 days, upon receipt. So if a complaint, it can take more than 3 days without being registered, which means the office is not complying with the target. So all the complaints that which were received by the office of the DPCI judge, we managed to register them within 72 hours upon receipt, and were allocated to the investigators for further investigation. In terms of this area, the target is that all the complaints that which we receive, 80% of those complaints received must be registered within 3 days or 72 hours. The office in this area managed to exceed the target. All the complaints that which were received were registered within 3 days. So 100% output in terms of this area. I will go to the next area of performance, which is about public awareness, conducting the public awareness campaign and the stakeholder meetings. The performance indicator to assess the performance of the office is the number of campaigns conducted by the office. In terms of the annual performance plan, the target is that each and every quarter, the office must conduct an awareness campaign, which means that per annum, 4 awareness campaigns must be conducted by the office. During the period under review, the office conducted 5 awareness campaigns. These awareness campaigns are aimed to promote the role and function of the Office of the DPCI Judge. Awareness campaigns were conducted at Congo in the Eastern Cape, Harrismith in the Free State, Nelspruit in Mpumalanga, Kimberley in the Northern Cape, and George in the Western Cape. The target in terms of this performance indicator is that 70% of campaigns must be conducted. So the office exceeded the target of 70% as set out in the annual performance plan. So in other words, that the office has exceeded, has achieved the target in terms of conducting the public awareness campaign. I will move to the next slide, that is slide number 10. The stakeholder meetings. As part of marketing the office is required to have stakeholder meetings with other stakeholders as part of marketing the office. The target in terms of the annual performance plan is that per quarter the office must have conducted two meetings with stakeholders. During the period under review, the office have conducted 8 meetings with various stakeholders. Stakeholders such as the Commission on Gender Equality, the Civilian Secretariat for Police, the State Security Agency, the National Director of Public Prosecution, the Acting National Commissioner of SAFT, the Head of the HOPS, the Independent Communication Authority of South Africa, and the traditional authorities. Let me indicate that during the period under review, there were some two traditional chiefs from the Eastern Cape who have invited the judge to come and address them. The chiefs, they indicated to the judge that they have got challenges in their communities, challenges such as stock theft, drug abuse, and other challenges which are facing the communities. And the judge honored the invitation and went to address the chiefs. And on that event, we managed to indicate to the chiefs what are the roles, what are the functions of the office of the DPCI judge. So in terms of the stakeholder meeting, the office during the period under review conducted 8 meetings with the stakeholders. So in other words, the target of conducting the meetings by the office of the DPCI judge was achieved. I will move to the next slide. That is page number 12. The performance management system. This, it deals with the compliance and the accountability in terms of the internal prescript. The office, during the period under review, the staff of the office of the DPCI judge have completed and submitted the performance agreement, the biannual performance assessment for the staff, the operational plan, the annual procurement plan, the strategic plan, and the annual performance plan. All these were submitted to the secretariat for compliance. The office have compiled monthly reports, the quarterly reports, the biannual reports, and the annual report. All these were submitted to the judge in order to assess the performance of the office. The target in terms of this is 100% to submit the above report, and the output was 100% in terms of the annual performance plan. I will move to the next slide, which is on page 13. It is dealing with the investigation of complaints. This is our core function. The reason why the office of the DPCI judge is established. Our key responsibility is to conduct investigation. As I've stated before, the performance indicator to assess or to measure the performance of the office is the number of the complaints finalized from the number of the complaints received. As far as investigation is concerned, during the period under review, we received a total of 69 complaints. And out of 69, 31 complaints were complaints falling within the scope of our mandate. And 38 complaints were complaints outside the scope of our mandate. The complaints falling within the scope of our mandate were 31. And out of 31, the office finalized 14 complaints. The target set in terms of the annual performance plan is that 70% of the complaints received during the period under review must be finalized. In this area, the office did not achieve the target. The output was 45%, and the target was lagging behind by 55%. So this means in the area of the complaints that which falling within the scope of our mandate, the office did not achieve the target. With regard to the complaints that are falling outside the scope of our mandate, we received a total of 38 complaints. And out of 38 complaints, 36 complaints were finalized. The output was 95%. The difference is that complaints which are not falling within the scope of our mandate, it is very easy to finalize them than the complaints that which are falling within the scope of our mandate. As far as the investigation of the complaints of the previous financial year, we had 12 complaints which were carried over, and out of 12 complaints, a total of 9 complaints were finalized. In terms of the annual performance plan, the target is that 50% of the cases from the previous financial year must be finalized. So the target, the output in terms of the finalization of the cases of the previous financial year was 75%, exceeding the target of 50% as set out in the annual performance plan. I will move to the next slide, which is page 14. The reasons why the target was not met. The target of finalizing the cases that which are falling within the scope of our mandate was not achieved. We achieved 45%, and the target was 70%. The reason, as stated, is lack of capacity. The office of the DPCI judge is understaffed to deal with all the responsibilities of the office. We only have 2 investigators who are overstretched to attend expeditiously and thoroughly to all the complaints in the various provinces. The same investigators are responsible for the administration of the office. For instance, during the marketing of the office, the inv- investigators have to interrupt their investigation, which is their core functions, and concentrate on the all efforts to market the office. The second reason is that lack of cooperation from the complainant. Some complainants do not cooperate with the investigation of the complaint. Section 17L of SARS Act is silent when coming to private individuals who are refusing to give evidence. Like, for instance, when we receive a complaint and the investigator is investigating such complaints, when we approach the private individuals, some of the witnesses, they refuse to cooperate. And there's nothing the office, the investigator can do because the act is very silent. We can only have the powers to persuade or to force the members of the South African police, but in respect of the private individuals, we cannot force them to give us evidence or to cooperate. The other reason is that some of the cases were at court. Some of the complaints could not be finalized because the pending criminal cases at court had an impact and a direct bearing on the investigation of complaints. We did not want to preempt the decision of the court. In the result, we opted to wait for the finalization of the court case where prejudice seemed unavoidable. Some of the cases were at the NGPP. So some of the prosecutors, they took long to make a decision on the cases, and we accordingly have to wait for the decision to be taken. I'll move to the next slide, which is page 16. Remedial measure to meet the target set for the complaints which do not fall within the scope of our mandate. The office realized that there are a lot of complaints that which are reported to the office which do not fall within the scope of our mandate. So in order to quickly deal with such complaints, we have developed a standard template where we refer such complaints to the other stakeholders that have got mandate to deal with such complaints as provided in terms of Section 17L5 of SARS Act. I'll move to slide number 17. The area which deal with the reports to the minister. As far as the reports to the minister are concerned, we compiled a total of 50 reports of findings of finalized complaints of the previous and the current financial year. The reports were submitted to the minister for his information or attention. In terms of submission of the reports to the minister, the turnaround time is that once a final report is signed off by the judge, the investigator is required to forward or to submit that report to the minister within 30 days after the judge has signed off the report. The target in terms of that is 80%. So as the office, we achieved the target, the output of 100%. All the reports that which were signed off by the judge, we were able to submit them to the minister for his attention within a period of 30 days. The next slide in page 18 is about the trends and recommendations. analysis to observe trends and patterns arising from the investigated complaints is conducted in order to improve efficiency and professionalism culture within the operation of the HOCS. Whenever the office of the DPCI judge receives complaints, every complaint we are obliged to analyze what are the trends, what are the weaknesses within the operations of the HOCS. And then if we identify weaknesses or trends, as the office of the DPCI judge, we have to advise the Minister of Police. During the investigation of the complaint, during the period under review, we observed that a minority of complaints sought to misuse the informal policy of SAPS for self-enrichment rather than assist the police to fight crime. We also observed that the HOCS, when they conduct investigation, they do not provide regular feedback of the progress of the cases to the complainant. We have observed that because most of the complaints at which we have investigated, most of the complainants were complaining that they do not know what is happening about their cases. They are not given progress. A person reported a case 3 years ago and will come and to our office and say that he does not know or she does not know what is happening about their case. So this is the weakness that which we have also observed in our analysis. That is the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you to the judge and the deputy director for the presentation. We will start now for tea with the questions. I see members are indicating maybe a few issues from my side. I think the important thing is the format of the presentation, because the portfolio committee needs to enable us to get the overview. It's important that in the next year, your next presentation, the financials should be indicated much more thoroughly, because there's nothing about your financial performance in the presentation, so we can't really make an we really can't give a thorough opinion. Even in the annual report, it's just broad figures. Now, of course, the accounting office is the Secretary of Police, is not able to be here today, but the dilemma is difficult for us to assess, because one of the arguments put forward today was we don't have enough budget and resources, but if you look at your annual report, you had a net of 700,000, so it doesn't tally up. So if you can maybe address that in your responses. Then I've listened attentively what the judge said about the issue of the levels of the staff. But if you go to page 5 of the annual report, the second bullet on the capacity of the office of the DPCI judge, it says, the Secretary of Police shall, in consultation with the office of the DPCI judge, prepare an annual operational plan which shall be for the specific and exclusive use of the official duties of the office. Now, we hear you what you're saying about the levels, but the reality is, if there's a problem with the levels, what the accounting officer should do, or the judge, is to immediately consult the Department of Public Administration to look at the levels, to do a job evaluation or a evaluation of the current status. I mean, we hear you, but actually, if that process hasn't been followed, we're not going to hear you on that. The third issue is with relation to the workload. Now, the core business is investigation. I don't see any memorandum of understanding with IPED, for example, to assist. But if I look at the caseload, we had, in Kailicha, the normal caseload is about 120 dockets per detective. Now, if we look at your dockets, it's 12 or 13, so it's 6 per investigator. So I just want to get more information. If that is the caseload, it's very, very low, unless it's very complex cases. and very difficult, but the case load is very, very low if you compare it with other investigative institutions. Honorable Mulubatsi.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson.
In terms of Section 17 of SAPS Act, your office needs to be known by awareness. But from your caseload, you just said, it's quite clear that your office is not known in the community. What are you going to do to improve the situation? My next one is on your feedback by investigators of DPCI. What do you do? Do you come to us and complain about it? What do you do to address this? My third one, in your mandate, you have a responsibility to improve efficiency and professionalism of the hawks. Is this happening in your own view? Is this really happening? That's it.
Thank you, Honorable and Honorable.
Thank you, Jefferson, and thank you for your presentation. In slide 16, you said you have developed a standard template for referring complaints. I don't know when did you develop that. I want to ask you that previously, what did you do with those complaints that are falling outside previously? Because now you are saying you have developed, I don't know when did you develop that template. Did you throw them or did you send them to the relevant department? In slide 13, you said 12 of your complaints you carried over. Are these complaints under investigation or what? In slide 14, in lack of capacity, you said you've got two investigators. How many investigators you are supposed to have in your department? Are those posts, if you have posts for investigators, I found a post or what? Because you said lack of capacity and there are two that are working. In slide 15, in slide 15, cases at the NDTP. After submitting cases to the prosecutor for a decision, what did you do? Are you making follow-ups or what? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Judge Cuomo and the team for the presentation. I've just got two comments and five questions, but the questions are quite short and straightforward. The first is just a comment on a matter that had, or an issue that had come up in last year's annual report presentation by the then Judge Musa, where I think I had, I'm not sure if the committee also echoed it, but I'd indicated that it would be very useful if we could have the case breakdown of the investigations completed and, well, certainly completed in the same way that IFID does in their Section 9N reports, so just detailing the province of origin for cases, the detail of the complaints, is it an HR issue, is it a whatever, the dates of it, just so we can get a slightly more detailed picture of the cases, because the figure of 31 doesn't necessarily tell us anything about what that's about. So if I can make that request again, and if it's possible, Chair, for I know the office of the DPCI judge really only comes before us once a year. If maybe the committee can get that in writing, whenever they can get that ready, and then the committee members can receive the written breakdown of that case information. And then my second comment is to just say that I am glad to hear that at least in this year's report there have been complaints from Hawks members, because there were absolutely none from the last reports, which Judge Musa did indicate was likely indicative of the fear of victimization from Hawks members. But I'm still concerned that it's only two. Given the organizational and mismanagement difficulties the Hawks had over the year in review, I find it hard to believe that only two Hawks members had grievances that they could refer to the DPCI judge. So there's clearly that factor still at play. Which then leads me to my first question, which is to ask, if you have the information here or you can recall from the top of your head, how many cases were initially submitted or lodged by Hawks members and then withdrawn in the year under review? Because I think that might start to give us a picture of what might be happening. My second question is, of those 29 complaints from members of the public, were any of those complaints from the former finance minister, Praveen Gordhan, for that witch hunt investigation that was happening against him and then mysteriously evaporated? My third question is, in terms of, it's from page 31, referencing page 31 of the annual report booklets, there is mention made of the fact that there's resistance or difficulty from some members of the Hawks when they're being investigated. And as the presentation said, there is provision in section 17, or subsection 7A, for a criminal, or certainly that's not cooperation, is a criminal offense. So to then ask, has anyone been charged for that offense of non-cooperation when that resistance has been encountered? And it's the same question I always ask of IFLIPT, because there's no good if there is provision to apply sanctions for non-cooperation with these investigations if those tools and provisions aren't then used to enforce accountability. So have we had any of those, it's a mouthful, section 17L subsection 7A offences opened against those uncooperative members? My third last question, Chair, and this relates to a matter that Judge Cuomo had mentioned in his opening remarks, echoing the late Judge Musa when he was presenting to us around this issue of a lack of enforcement powers. One of the aspects of that, when the committee was unpacking what he meant by the lack of enforcement powers, is he seemed to be under the impression that investigators, the investigators employed by the office of the DPCI judge did not have arresting powers. I forgot to then follow up on that, but can I just get confirmation from the investigators in terms of the terms of your employment, deployment, etc., do you have arresting powers? Because I know certainly for the IFLIPT investigators that's something that is explicitly provided for. So do you have arresting powers as part of your mandate and the means to execute that? Second last question, Chair, from page 7 of the annual reports book, the Chair already mentioned the problem of the fact that we don't have a detailed and comprehensive financial report. But what I do glean from the information we have there is that the cost of procurement for marketing materials came to just under 150,000 Rand. And when I look at the breakdown of what was procured, I'm having great difficulty understanding how those came to that figure. It's two deluxe gazebos, two media banners, two exhibition stands, six pull-up banners, 20 flag banners, four magazine racks, 10 sleeveless vests, 1,000 caps, 2,000 shuttle bags, and 100 memory sticks. And what informs my confusion and skepticism is that these are the tools of trade also for political parties. Gazebos, pull-up banners, flag banners, caps, t-shirts, and based on the costs I've seen attached to these kinds of items, even at these quantities, I am not understanding how we get to 150,000 for that kind of shopping list. So can I just get some explanation, possibly from the administrative staff, as to what's going on there? Because there's either some price inflation going on, or there's something that I'm not understanding, please, about that. And then my last question is, then from page 13 of the annual report, it is mentioned that there was the discussion around how do we give effects to subsection 13 around the budgets of the office of the DPCI judge. And there's complications because National Treasury must weigh in, they're at miss right now, and blah, blah, blah. So in the absence of ring funding and given the difficulties of trying to achieve that, could we just get an indication of how then will adherence to that subsection 13 around the exclusive, the wording is exclusive and specific use of the duties of the office be assured? Because in the previous financial year, we had the difficulty, well, more than difficulty, a problem, where some of the funds of the office of the DPCI judge were effectively poached for other issues that came up during the year under the previous minister, and we need for that not to be a problem. So how do we assure adherence to that stipulation in the absence of ring fencing? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Members, 10-minute tea break, and then we'll come back for further questions. Thank you.
Have two investigators, but other than that, you claim you're also otherwise understaffed. So it would be very helpful to have your wish list of what you think would make, what contingent you would need to make this entity work at an optimal level. Obviously, only having two investigators is just ridiculous. But you have hit all the other targets, reports, meetings, outreach programs, you've hit all of those and surpassed them. But your core mandate is your investigations. And now you've only got two investigators. So what would you need, I think is what I'm looking for. And please explain to me what sort of cases you describe as being out of your mandate. There were 38 of them. I'm not sure why they would come to you in the first place. Are individual citizens coming directly to your offices? How is it working that you are ending up with cases that should not have been coming to you? I think Honourable Mbele is absolutely right. We need perhaps fuller information when you have a presentation like this. It would be most helpful to say, this is what we achieved before, or this was the aim, because you have to fish through and find, oh, yes, actually 30 was the target. But we need a diagram perhaps saying, in these years, this was the target, or this is our latest target, yes, we reached it, or yes, we got 80% of it, so we can see it in a graphic format. including all previous investigation years, although you haven't been going that long. You say you've done 5 awareness campaigns. If that, again, I read plowed through and found you've exceeded your target by 1. But does that target setting determine where the awareness campaigns are held? I'm not sure. Have you covered all the provinces, or have you done half the country, or how has it worked? Again, I think too little information. And finally, could you clarify why it would be, and I have my own ideas, that a complainant would refuse to cooperate? So they've put in a complaint about something that a member perhaps of the DPCI has done to them or to a family member, and suddenly they're refusing to cooperate. That immediately says to me, are they being leaned on by the members they've now reported? Are they scared? Why would they possibly back off, having had the courage to come to you with a complaint? Could you explain and maybe give us answers as to how you intend getting around this? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kota Barnard. Honourable Songa.
Well, thanks, Jefferson. Mine will be just a much more general kind of question. First of all, maybe if one can be clarified about the question of that was presented by the judge, that you lack enforcement powers. You lack enforcement powers on matters that you are supposed to investigate. I don't understand. Does it mean that maybe you cannot take people to court or something like that, charge them formally? I don't know if then that area can be clarified. But then lastly, Honourable Judge, is the question that the country seems to, at the moment, to be under siege. And one of your colleagues, one of the judges, particularly following the breaking of the news that FBI is investigating this family which has captured this country almost in its entirety. This judge says, is South Africa still a rule of law? He's your colleague. Is South Africa still a rule of law that you will get foreign law enforcement agencies investigating matters emanating from South Africa, yet from the side of Hawks and NPA, there is zero action? Now, you have this kind of posture that part of your task is to ensure that there is professionalism, efficiency, or within the Hawks. I don't understand if maybe one can be highlighted there, because I myself, and I think Honorable Jefferson will agree with me, I've asked this question several times, even to the general leading the Hawks, to say, when the people are crying helplessly in the country like this, almost everyone in the country, and I'm sure that Honorable Judge, you are aware that even the committee here of Parliament is propping this thing called state capture, where hard evidence is brought before that, no action, nothing, as if just South Africa is just becoming a paradise of criminal activity, driven from the highest, including people who are supposed to be supporting even you at a political level of hierarchy of this country. It is these things, Jefferson and Honorable Judge, that at times put me under stress to say, I've got a reason to join that judge to say, is South Africa really still the rule of law? There's such things. Such things are just happening under our nose with almost 100% impunity. And no action, no freezing of banks, nothing. I personally, I don't even know whether then there is still a place called South Africa today. Really, if I were to just generally say that thing, even only if you will get such things happening without any kind of action. That is all that I just wanted to raise, Chairperson, because maybe we can then talk about then the structure, whether then the structure, when it was formed, when it comes to the human resource development and all that. But I just wanted to find out that, because it's quite stressful to all of us. Is South Africa still a rule of law? Is there any action? Why not even a single bank of these people is frozen when you've got a highly charged unit like the Hawks that is supposed to be actually penetrating these things and even accessing information? Seems to me to be there, just abundantly there, but nothing. What will make me, Honorable Judge, to actually then say, indeed, there is anything to talk of in terms of the output? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Yes, I think some of the issues is operational issues, but the head of the BCI is tomorrow here at 9, so the members also welcome to raise it directly with her. But let's go to the Judge Homer and his team for the responses. Thank you.
Chairperson, I'll ask Mr. Rashi Weaver to respond to most of the questions first, and then I will deal with remaining others, because in my case it's a bit anecdotal, and he has been hands-on, if you allow me.
Thank you, Judge Homer. He's welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The first question is about the financial performance of the office. We did not give much details of how did we spend the budget, because in the previous presentation it was agreed that we must leave it to Secretariat. It was indicated that in the next briefing we need to come with the Secretariat and they need to account how did we spend the budget.
Well, maybe, I mean, this is the annual report, so I think without wasting time, because we're running out of it, is to indicate we need much more comprehensive financial information in the next 2 weeks, so that we can analyze it and see what is the problem. Because it's difficult for us as a committee now to reflect on your annual report without the real detailed information. You can go ahead, sir.
Okay. The next question is about the workload, where you indicated that the volume of complaints is very low compared to the detectives at SAPS. I think you said at IPED. During the previous financial year, we, as part of marketing the office of the DPCI judge, we have entered into several MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with all the Chapter 9 and the law enforcement and with other civil society in order to refer complaints where, if they fall within our mandate, those structures, they refer such complaints. But since the Office of the DPCI Judge was established, though the volume of complaints is still low, however, every year we can see that the increase is, that the complaints are increasing. If you can check, since we started, every year the number of complaints are increasing. But we have entered into a memorandum of understanding with all the law enforcement, and so that whenever they receive a complaint that which is falling within our mandate, they can refer it to us. The next question is about that our office is not known the public. And what are we doing to improve the situation? In order to improve the situation, the awareness campaign is a continuous process. You know, we conduct awareness campaigns to all the provinces. Some of the provinces we deal with it, and we can conduct awareness campaigns 2 or 3 times. So we hope that when we conduct the awareness campaigns, we do invite all the stakeholders, the civil societies, the faith-based organizations, all the community structures, so that they can inform the public what is the functions, what is the role of the office of the DPCI judge. We hope by doing so, these awareness campaigns, it will project the office to another level. The question about the lack of feedback to the complainants by the investigators of the hawks. This is a concern that which we have raised to the hawks. Since the new judge was appointed, we are traveling to all the provinces and inform all the members of the hawks. We are introducing the new judge, and on that event, this is where we highlighted to members of the hawks that these are the types of complaints, most of the complaints that we receive from you. And one of the complaints is that the investigators are not giving feedback. So we have highlighted to them, and then they promised that whenever they conduct investigation, they are going to provide feedback to the complainant. So we have so far now we have traveled to 8 provinces. We are left with 1 province, which is Northwest. The question about the standard template. The question was the complaints that which were falling outside our mandate. What were we doing with those complaints before we developed the standard template? Those complaints we did not have a template before, so we used to refer them in terms of. We have got the power to refer a complaint to any other structure in terms of section 17L5. Then after we realized that a lot of complaints are... After we have observed that a lot of complaints are not falling within our mandate, we decided that as the office, let's develop a template where we can be able to deal with such complaints in a quick way. Because some of them, they were taking our time. Some of the complaints, you need to conduct preliminary investigation in order to ascertain whether the complaint is falling within our mandate or not. So not all the complaints you can refer outright immediately. You need first to conduct a preliminary investigation. So some of the information is not cleared. So hence we have to conduct a preliminary investigation. Once we are certain that this complaint is not falling within the scope of our mandate, then we refer it to other stakeholders. So the importance of the template is to where we receive a complaint which is not falling within our mandate and we've got all the information, then we immediately refer, we use that template and then refer the complaint to the relevant stakeholder. The complaints that which were carried over, whether those complaints are still under investigation or not. I've indicated that I think we have carried over 12 complaints from the previous financial year, and out of those 12, we finalized 9 complaints, which means there were 3 outstanding, which were complaints, which we still need further investigation. The issue of a lack of capacity. There is a task team which has been established, or a team at the secretariat, they are reviewing the structure. So they wanted our input on how many posts do we need as the office. So we have given them information that in terms of our structure, these are the posts that which we needed. We have submitted that and to the secretariat, and we hope that we have requested additional investigators and also one admin officer with skills of finance. So, yeah, that was 3 weeks ago. So we hope that the required post will approve and they will approve them. I think those are the few questions which I will answer in the meantime, and then I will answer the other questions in the next round.
Chairperson, if I may start with the question of our wish list. What is really very urgent is that we need to get the name, really does not matter that much, but the sort of the CEO, because what I'm bogged down with is the administration. Anything that has to be done has to come past me. And I must say the secretariat, there are blockages. Everything, even things that we agreed upon, come back to us, make a submission to me. And let me just give you one example, which has delayed just about everything. The very first day, the 6th of October, the following day, the 6th of October, we were in Cape Town. The day thereafter, we met with the secretariat and everyone, and we had agreed, even with the Secretary General of the Office of the OCJ, that I will bring my secretary with me. They agreed, they said, deal with the, with your secretariat and let the secretary come. I can tell you now that everything that you see here has been typed by myself and Mr. Rassi Wheeler. I still operate without a secretary. And that's totally frustrating, and I must then just say quickly, thank you very much to your advice that we should then make contact with the Department of Public Administration to really expedite this. I know that the minister has said these things must be, you know, expedited, but we get bogged down. And then as to the wish list, those are absolutely urgent. The other matters we will deal with, as also advised by you, as to the levels and so forth, and together with what Mr. Rasmila has said, that we met with the secretariat to give them what we would require. And we hope in due course to also have an office in KZN, which means that an office in KZN and an investigator in the Western Cape, because we don't have an investigator in the Western Cape. I think, Chairperson, it's a bit awkward, because sometimes we have to request IPED, because we don't have a presence, to to transmit complaints to us. They would not handle it the way that we would want to handle them. And also, there may be certain biases. And although sometimes now I will speak a bit prospectively and not retrospectively, because this report really ends by the 31st of March. But in our travels, and we have gone to eight provinces, it's only Northwest where we had not been. We have discovered that, in truth, members of the Hawks have not raised the cases relevant. They have not. So we have packaged those cases. I've packaged those cases. I've given them the cases relevant to them, and also cases where, say, of the powers of the Public Protector and others, so that they can benchmark us with them and how we're going to deal with the complaints. We were very much surprised. I think the office that stood out where cases have been read really in the Western Cape, we were highly impressed that. And as I say, we speak prospectively. The members of the Hawks were afraid to speak out because they feared reprisals, intimidation, and some of them believed it was career limiting. And we pointed out to them, Chairperson, that this very Section 17 says that they need not go through their seniors to report to us. In fact, we said to them, it's preferable that they come to us, because that's really our function. And in the meantime, some matters were then reported to us, and some people will still come to us because we're still hitting the road. And Chairperson, when we have our CEO to man the office so that we could release the investigators. There was the question of enforcement powers. The way I understood it is that the problem does not lie during the investigation, Chairperson, because the criminal sanctions, basically, it's during investigation. If we say to a directorate, help us in this respect, and they are listed, the Commissioner of Police, Provincial Commissioners, the NDPP, and so forth, and even Chapter 9 institutions. If they don't, then there is this criminal sanction. That's not where the problem lies. The problem lies, the investigation has been done, and the DPCI judge now signs off and says, now, this is what we recommend. Now, if it's the Public Protector, those, if I can call it, remedial actions that we recommend are binding. What about us? We send it to the minister. The minister doesn't respond. What I have discovered is that, and I must hasten to say that, it's not the current minister, because the DPCI judge died on the 26th of February, and that the current minister came in after that, and I came in only in October, so it does not refer to the current minister. So those matters have been referred to the minister. The question is, well, what then we have sent this, and the question did arise, what do we do if what we have recommended is not implemented? So that is still the question, and that's why I say, Chairperson, if we are given the opportunity to look at all this, get senior counsel's advice, maybe we can then approach with something more comprehensive. We don't want to seem as if we want powers. The Auditor General waited, I think, some 22, 23 years before they asked for teeth. We should not be overly eager to do so. Maybe something can work. Chairperson, arresting powers, no. The investigators are not police officers, and I'm happy that they don't have arresting powers. We investigate complaints. We don't investigate crimes. The complainant's rights must be violated, or, certainly sometimes a crime may have been committed because, and this is what we told the Hawks, that we're not going to pull punches where someone influences or interferes with an investigation, make this case go away. That's defeating the ends of justice. And what we have said also, Chairperson, is that we would wish for the seniors, even if it seems to them that the complaint may have been frivolous and whatnot, not to be over-eager to deal with people who have complained, because they will receive our reports. This is when everything has been done. I know I did not go along with and then the question was, there are complaints that the Hawks aren't doing anything. Chairperson, you were at the award of the Hawks. I was there. I spoke there. But what really has encouraged me and heartened me is that the acting head of the Hawks, Lieutenant General Matakata, has pointed out that the Hawks are currently suffering from a legitimacy problem, and that they need to do something about it. But then let me also say this about the DPCI lacking or maybe cannot act proactively unless someone complains. It's not entirely correct. For instance, I read in a newspaper about someone, I think it's the Tony Lewis, who wrote an open letter and said he complained to the Hawks some time back and nothing has been done. I wrote to him to say, well, it's not helpful to write an open letter mentioning names or bending names of people who may be completely innocent. And I said to him, as soon as we have dealt with all these issues, we will take on his complaint. And I know that some files have reached us from that quarter, and it's a number of files, and we'll deal with them. And I can assure you that if we get information, maybe not directly from a complainant, but we know that this is in fact a complaint because this person may sometimes not know where to complain to, we contact this person and say, please come, would you be prepared to do this? And finally, Chairperson, the complaints that have been withdrawn, it's a bit tricky. As I go through the files, and this is what delays me, because when I'm told something, I must also check, although it happened previously, before I say something to you. One of the complaints that has been withdrawn troubled me. And although my predecessor has dealt with it, I could see no reason. It's like a criminal case where a complainant withdraws a complaint invalidly, because it troubles me the reason why the complaint is being withdrawn against a member of the Hawks. So we're re-looking that. That's nothing that prevents us from looking at those. This is a broad outline. I know that I may not have answered all questions or all of them satisfactorily for current purposes, Chairperson.
Thank you, Judge. We want to wrap up this engagement because I think it will be quite clear that we will have to call you back, maybe with the Secretary of Police, that we can look at the logistical issues that it must be sorted out quite quickly, but also look at the medium to long-term issues about capacity. Of course, the issue of legislation, that needs attention during the SEPS legislative review process, hopefully next year. But let's deal with the other issues, sir. You can just complete the responses. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There was a question about the complaint of Mr. Gordon. The straight answer is that we never received a complaint from Mr. Gordon. There was a question about the breakdown of complaints. Yes, we did not prepare the breakdown for the complaint. But what we can inform this House is that in terms of the provinces, the majority of the complaints that which we receive, the top province is Gauteng, followed by Western Cape, and the other provinces they share, maybe we can receive two or three complaints. We think we will submit a written reply regarding this question as the Honourable Member has requested.
Chairperson, also, thank you for the advice about how IP breaks this down. We'll speak to them, we'll look at them, because we learn from them and give you something in writing much better than we have done.
Judge, for the sure, because it's important in benchmarking that we can compare apples with apples. I mean, the example of the Khayelitsha detective with 100 plus dockets, live dockets, and you know, your caseload. So we need this committee to actually be able to ascertain whether you're on course or not. Let's get to the other responses. Thank you.
The type of cases which are falling outside our mandate, what type of those cases? The bottom line is that those cases, they do not involve members of the Hawks, or they do not arise from the investigation conducted by the Hawks.
Hence, we categorize them as complaints which are not falling within the scope of our mandate. But the majority of complaints are complaints against subs members, complaints of service delivery. The other complaints are complaints against the department. Department of Labor, complaints of corruption, complaints of nepotism. Those complaints, they do not arise from the investigation of conducted by the Hawks. The question around the expenditure of 150. Let me indicate that the marketing of the office of the DPCI judge is managed by the communication unit of the Discipline Secretariat. So whenever they procure promotional materials for the office, they do that in consultation with our office. So we are aware that these materials, promotional materials, were procured, and the expenditure was 150. The question of non-cooperation by Hawks members. Our approach is that we don't want to enforce our powers. Even though the legislation gave us the powers, there are a few cases that which we do experience resistance from some few members of the Hawks. But our approach is to persuade them. We engage them so that they cooperate. And if they are not cooperating, we also involve their commanders until they cooperate. Yeah, these are the few questions which I can answer for now.
Thank you, Judge.
Chairperson, one aspect that I omitted, I was astounded by the Secretariat. The Act says that the money to the DPCI judge must be ring-fenced. It must be ring-fenced. This is what the law says. If the secretary says it won't be ring-fenced, it means he says he'll break the law. And we can't encourage that. I can't encourage that. If our money is ring-fenced, it will be ring-fenced. Otherwise, if he does not want to do that, then he must suffer the consequences. I can't stand for that. I can't encourage breaking of the law. That's absolutely a no-no.
Judge me like that. I saw other members. I really want to close it. At this stage, we've got an hour left. Honourable Mulubachi.
Thank you, Chair. The input that was made by, just forgot the surname.
Siwila.
Yeah. You said you don't want to enforce powers. I'm worried about that. When things are not going right, you choose not to enforce powers. I'm worried, Chair. Thanks.
Maybe Mr. Rasvila has not expressed himself as he should be. It's basically a reference to if someone does not do this, and then you go and say, okay, you have not done so. It's a criminal offense. Investigate. Before we can do that, maybe there is a quicker way of getting the same result. That's only what it means. I don't think it means anything more than that. And maybe if I can just say this to you, we have referred them to the case of Rex versus Tenga. The DPP in the the Northern Cape, where we believe that the regional court was over eager to act against the DPP, when obviously there are other means that they should have done, and on that basis we set aside the conviction, because we think that that was an overreach, and that's basically that. It does not mean that we will not do what we have to do, so if we can allay that fear.
Thank you very much, Judge, and your delegation for the presentation. Maybe just the way forward, I think it's going to be critical that there must be a bilateral between yourselves and the Secretariat of Police to deal with the logistical issues, the issue of the budget, so when you come back that those issues can be dealt with. Secondly, the further information requested by the members in terms of the cases, the tabulation of the province, but also the budget information is not sufficient for annual report purposes, so we would need to have that to interrogate it much more thoroughly. And then we will, hopefully in February, our program is very full the first term, but create an opportunity again for you to come back, Judge, and also the Secretary, Mr. Mpia, was unfortunately not available today, that we can look at those issues that's currently hampering your effective functioning, and also look at the capacity issues. I mean, there's 3 months to go before February, maybe engagement with the assistance of the Secretariat, with the Department of Public Service and Administration, to look at your levels, look at your overall strength of the organization compared to your intake, to maybe go through that exercise, and when you come back to the committee, give us, objective overview, because all the departments say they do not got enough staff and capacity, but there must be objective tests, and we don't see it in your documentation, so that's what we're going to look at. So thank you very much, Judge. We will give 3 minutes break for members, and then we'll ask the DNA judge, the DNA board, to come forward. Thank you. Agenda, the DNA board. I'm going to first ask the honourable members to introduce themselves.
Dumelang bagaetsho, leina la ka ke nna Angie Molewatsi, ke leloko la committee e ke a leloga.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Phindile Mola, a member of this control committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Zakele Mbele, member of the committee.
I'm Diane Kalabana, also member of the committee.
I'm Philip Mshango, member of the committee.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mthlungu. I'm going to ask George Makoro to just introduce the delegation, and then I'll just do the introduction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good day. And members, honourable members of this committee, my name is Yvonne Makoro. I am the chairperson of what we now know as the DNA board. And I am here with the deputy chairperson, Vanessa Lynch, who is going to make the presentation, briefing the committee. And we also have Kevin Ellis, who is a member of the board. And then we have Mr. Mark Rogers, who is the newly appointed secretary. If you remember the last time we appeared before this board, we had nobody to assist us. So we have now appointed Mark Rogers, who heads the administration of the board. And then we have Don Bell, who is here, not as part of us, but not as part of the board, but as a representative of Mr. Rapier. She is part of the Civilian Secretariat for Police Service. Mr. Chairman and members of this honorable committee, we are not going to, as you know, to present our full report, and we hope that as soon as we submit it, we will get an opportunity to do that, Mr. Chairperson, later. But we are here to give the committee a briefing of, in particular, our strategic and operational challenges which we face as the board. We will also take the opportunity to draw the attention of this honorable committee to the fact that we will have proposed legislation, legislative amendment, that we will make later, and draw your attention to that fact, brief you briefly on what the issues are there, and hopefully get your support so that when we come back to make the final presentation, members of this honorable committee will have a very good idea what the issues are there. And as you know, one of the functions of the board is to draft policies and draft procedures and make recommendations to improve the DNA legislation for efficacy, make it as effective as possible. And for the first time now, since our appointment, we have this pending amendment act which we would like to introduce to improve the efficacy of the act. I will give the Deputy Chairperson, Vanessa Lynch, to make the presentation. And so, members of the board, I leave you in the capable hands of Vanessa Lynch.
No, thank you, Judge, for the introduction. Maybe I appreciate your introduction, but there's first one issue that we must deal with as the Oversight Institution of Parliament, because we debated this issue at the Management Committee. Now, all entities and government departments are supposed to table officially their annual reports in terms of the relevant legislation to Parliament before we can deal with this committee. In terms of your own legislation, Section 15AC1 provides for the board to report on its functions to Parliament annually. Now, that tabling hasn't taken place, but we at management thought it's going to be important to hear the challenges, the issues, because we've seen during this term, if portfolio committees do not ensure that there's regular oversight on entities and departments, it might lead to greater problems later. So it's important that we have the session. But maybe, Judge, if you can just advise the committee, the delay and the non-compliance with the legislation, the reasons, and what is being done to address it, and when can we expect the annual report at committee level. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that indulgence, Mr. Chairman. Indeed, I think we ought to have started by apologizing for not having submitted our report, and we do so. And the challenge there that faced us was simply that, whereas our report is ready for submission, we have not yet obtained the go-ahead in the form of the signature of the minister to submit our report. And we are due to meet the minister tomorrow, and hopefully by tomorrow we will get the signature and we'll be able to submit the report.
Thank you so much for your indulgence.
For drawing the attention to that. I need to apologize.
That, but I think from the committee side, it's going to be important for the Borders Executive Authority and the new administrator, Mr. Rogers, to ensure in future that the communication with the Executive Authority is done early enough, you know, that there is a mechanism to ensure that that report is signed in time, because for the oversight cycle, it's difficult to properly assess it in time and to ensure that we have proper oversight over the entity. So we will today, we will allow, of course, the input, because we must keep our eye on the issues at hand,
Honourable Chair, and good afternoon, Honourable Members. Many of you are familiar faces, and here today we are going to report on some good things and some bad things, which is often the case, and I'm sure a part of what you hear every day. And again, from our side, apologies for not timely submitting our annual report. There have been many operational challenges, and certainly our new secretariat was thrown into the deep end, having newly been appointed. So if you could bear with us, the report is finalized, and it certainly will be on the table first thing next year. The full report will contain a lot of the challenges as well as the successes of the board over the last year. I think today, and we thank you for allowing us this opportunity today, despite the fact that we don't have our annual report, is to really highlight a few urgent issues that have come to our attention, and certainly as committed board members, we are hoping that as a portfolio committee that you will be able to assist us with some necessary interventions in order to ensure that these are dealt with urgently and timeously. There's been so much work that has been put into the infrastructure in the forensic science laboratory, and certainly we don't want to see what possibly could result in literally a train hitting a wall if we don't all pull together and address these issues. So for the first part of the presentation, I'm not going to spend too much time because we will have an opportunity next year. I am going to move fairly quickly through that, but obviously if there are questions thereafter to be addressed, and move towards more the substantive issues which you have kindly allowed us to present to you today. As you are aware, our oversight is not only ethical in terms of complaints and ensuring that the National Forensic DNA Database is utilised in the way in which it has been envisaged by the legislation and originally by yourselves, but also to ensure the overall performance of the National Forensic DNA Database and all of the many factors that contribute towards its successes. That's not only in respect of on-the-ground training of police officers and following up of leads, but also in terms of the actual performance of the forensic science laboratory and ensuring that they comply with the time limits that have been put upon them. So that is our oversight function, and we meet regularly with the stakeholders to ensure that all of those mechanisms are in fact functioning. You've seen the slides previously, and just to remind you and bring light to the fact that we have a multi-function in as much as there are certain transitional arrangements that once they have been completed will be complete in terms of our mandate. There are also ongoing functions which we have, and then there are obviously the administrative functions. So today particularly we're looking at the oversight of performance and the transitional arrangements which were put in place to ensure that the handover from the old systems in the forensics laboratory to the new systems take place smoothly and within a certain time frame. And obviously that's quite pressing in terms of what's going on right now. The composition of the board we won't get into, but it remains the same. The addition, as you know now, that we do have a DNA secretariat, which certainly going forward will ensure that the board members who all have full-time jobs and do this on a part-time basis will now be supported by a full-time secretariat who will be able to pull together all of those functions that previously we were doing in terms of our subcommittees. So the subcommittees remain the same, and today really the subcommittees that are going to be presented in terms of this presentation are the transitional arrangements, and there are certain functions of the subcommittees that have to ensure that in terms of section, I think it's 7 of the Act, that those transitional arrangements do in fact take place. Appoints and infrastructure to a certain extent in terms of the operational challenges that we continue to face, and the systems reports and gaps analysis, which is a hugely important subcommittee that looks at the performance and the gaps. So it's all very well to say that we're receiving, for instance, a certain number of buckle samples, but if those numbers aren't in fact matched by what's actually happening on the National Forensic DNA Database, we have to look as to why there is a gap between the two. So the strategic and operational challenges of the board itself, and the fact that this report, which we've spoken about initially, we haven't managed to get the necessary infrastructure to get forward, is that we still don't have an independent office. And kindly, the DPCI has allowed us, the judge always used the words, squat in their offices very kindly, but that literally is what it is. Mark shares an office with a kettle and the fax machine, and despite that, and his administrative assistant is based in the CFP. So despite that, we do continue to fight for an independent operating space, an independent website. We don't even so much as have an independent IT infrastructure where we all have our own email addresses. And obviously this does impact on the way in which we function in terms of being able to, you know, to get things done when we need it to be done. These things are being dealt with, and hopefully by the next annual report, because we have a progress report that's attached to it, we should have some certainty going forward. We have got the support of the Civilian Secretariat for Police, and certainly we have a budget that allows us, but if you don't get the Public Works to come on board and provide us with an office, then there's nothing that we can do with a budget that allows us to actually use that to rent offices. So those operational challenges 3 years down the line will still sit with us, and as you can imagine, not very lightly. So today, going forward with the substantive issues, we need to talk very earnestly about the convicted offender sampling and the struggles that are taking place with regards to this particular category of persons who form a very integral part of our national forensic DNA database. We also need to talk about the budget of the Forensic Science Laboratory, which when the DNA bill was reviewed by this committee, and certainly when the implementation plan was supported at the time by the government to ensure that there would be compliance with it, has unfortunately been cut. And thirdly, we need to look at the task teams, because it's all very well to have these infrastructures in place, but unless you actually have the detectives following up on these leads, then all the hard work that's been put beforehand really goes to null. So that those are the three issues. I want to bring this case because often we talk in terms of reports and we talk in terms of numbers, but as many of you probably know me, and I'm very passionate about this, is that when you talk about people and human losses, and sadly I was at another very good friend's funeral on Saturday who had been brutally murdered in Johannesburg, you understand that actually this is what we're doing here. And this particular case has been resolved purely as a result of the National Forensic DNA Database and purely as the result of the implementation of this Act. And this particular person, who is described as a monster lurking in the shadows, attacking, robbing and raping girls, was how Deputy Judge President Patricia Goliath described the modus operandi of this Cape Town serial rapist who was recently sentenced to 15 life terms and an additional 120 years. And the reason I'm bringing this to your attention today is because the breakthrough in this particular investigation occurred when McKee was serving 11 months for assault, unrelated to any of the rapes for which he was finally convicted. And what happened is that he was convicted, and because of the DNA Act at the time, in 2015, by the time he was sampled, which allowed the police officer, a trained police officer, to take a reference or a buccal sample from this particular individual. This DNA profile, which was the result of the analysis, was entered onto the National Forensic DNA Database. And they got over 30 hits to unsolved cases. And it was as a result of this that they not only solved these cases, linked this particular person to all of those, but they were able to take him off the streets because invariably he would have been let out after 11 months and continued with his spree. And this just shows you how important it is and how important the convicted offender index is. We are also dealing currently with another case in the Forensic Science Laboratory that hasn't yet come to court that they're working on, where there are 50 unsolved crime scene samples cases that have been linked to one individual. So in terms of Section 7 of the DNA Act, and I think going backwards in terms of this, there was actually more of an administrative or typographical oversight, is that there was an expiry period 2 years after the implementation of the Act within which the convicted offender population had to be sampled. This expired in January 2017 with the result that no more convicted offenders are allowed to be sampled. The result of this is that convicted offenders are being released without having their samples taken because there is no provision in the Act that allows it. When we look at the case that I have just described, we understand that what we are doing is potentially releasing serial offenders back onto the street. And it is something that we can't allow. We therefore, as the DNA Board, put an urgent recommendation in to make an amendment to the Act as part of our mandate, as you know, for recommendations to improvement to the legislation, to ensure that this expiry period is in fact extended. If I take you back, the strict interpretation of this section was that sampling cannot continue after the expiration of the 2 years. But actually the intention of the legislature at the time of drafting this provision was to expedite the sampling of the convicted offender population because it was understood that this was such an important category of persons to put onto the database under the convicted offender index. Knowing that they would probably be linked to cold cases, it would also act as a deterrent before the person was released to ensure that should there come a case where they had an unknown person, they could link it to a known person. Unfortunately, due to operational challenges such as training of the police officers, refusals by some of the convicted offenders and system requirements in that the DCS, which is the Department of Correctional Services Systems, were not actually in line with those of the SAPS. They weren't able to understand whether the person who had been sampled was in fact on their system. But there were operational challenges that weren't anticipated at the time of passing the Act. And it was, in hindsight, far too short a period to in fact get the convicted offender population on board. Slightly further on in the Act, interestingly enough, there's another provision that says in the event that this period expires, you can apply to the Minister of Police for an extension of the period. Unfortunately, this didn't apply directly to this particular section. So we are now faced with having to come back to the Portfolio Committee with an amendment that has to pass through the Development Committee and through the Cabinet in order for us to say, can we please have this extended? This bill, fortunately, had been drafted, and you all have a copy of it. You should have a copy of it on your person. They were printed out for you this morning. Has gone through various stages, and Advocate Dawn Bell here has been involved, and the CFP is leading this process. It's gone to the Development Committee, and unfortunately it has hit a bit of a snag there too, because they want an implementation plan and a budget. This is an unfortunate situation insofar as the convicted offender population hasn't changed since the time that the bill was in fact enacted. So the funds that were actually promised at that time should still be available because nothing has changed insofar as the number of convicted offenders that were due to be sampled is in fact the same. Nevertheless, the Development Committee are in fact meeting again on Thursday. The SAPs had to bring further information forward, and we are hoping that at that time it will go to the next stage, which will be signing off by the Minister of Police. Then it will go on to Cabinet, and then hopefully it will come before yourselves. Our request today is that when it does come before yourselves, is to give you a little bit of background as to why it's important and to understand that it's not really anything other than an administrative amendment and that we need to get back to a position where we are sampling convicted offenders as urgently and as quickly as possible. A copy of the draft bill, as you say, has been presented, and obviously any questions at that time will be discussed throughout the Portfolio Committee, but we thought it prudent to bring it to your attention in the hope that when it does come through that we're able to get it onto its path as soon as possible. In the meantime, we have no choice but to release convicted offenders without sampling them. The next slide is, I think, quite an exciting slide, actually, because it represents that we almost have 900,000 profiles on our National Forensic DNA Database. And I can recall personally, 10 years ago, that figure was 35,000. The growth of the database has been purely as a result of the implementation of the DNA Act, and the size of the database is directly linked to the successes in terms of linking known offenders to unknown. So in terms of the various, unfortunately in your printed copy it's only got two of the indexes printed, but actually from the slide there you'll see that there are the six indices. And obviously in terms of the provisions of the law, the expungement provisions apply after a certain amount of time in terms of an arrestee who hasn't been convicted, and obviously in terms of the investigative index. But the reason I'm showing you this is that the performance of the Forensic Science Laboratory has been phenomenal. They have really worked incredibly hard to ensure that they comply with the provisions of the Act, which actually is quite strict in terms of its timelines. We work and meet with them regularly in terms of them supplying reports. So there's this oversight mechanism constantly in place that they have to report back to us in terms of what they're doing. And the growth of this exponentially, if it continued on this path, would ultimately result in a percentage of our criminal population being represented on the database, and ultimately you would see a mechanism that, like we have no other mechanism, would be able to link serial offenders and offenders to their crimes. So what we're looking for on the database is actually hits, or they call them investigative leads. So you can see there in terms of those figures that by August this year, they had linked almost 20,000 cases, okay, with known persons. So that means that the moment they process a crime scene sample and they analyze it, that unknown, because that's an unknown profile, because we don't know from whom, who was at the crime scene, that's loaded onto the database, it immediately links to 19,987 known people. I mean, that really is, in terms of administrative, in terms of investigative, it's a phenomenal methodology and it's a phenomenal tool that we have. The number of known persons, that means that when we take a reference sample either from a convicted offender or from an arrestee, which has been put onto the database, they link that directly to 7,584 cases. The next number of 11,475 is where they actually link unknown profiles together, which shows that a serial offender is in place. So even if you don't have a suspect, what you can start doing is you can start linking seemingly unrelated cases together, building up a modus operandi, understanding that you're dealing with the same person committing similar or dissimilar crimes, depending on what they are. And the moment that that person is arrested, or the moment that that person is convicted, or convicted if it's a convicted offender sample, you are able to link that particular person. And that's why we have always understood that the development and the size of the database is so important. So the hit rate, I think, previously was under 0.01% because the size of the database was so small. But obviously, in terms of the size of the database, the hits are going to be so much more, and the resolution of the crime so much more. In order for them to continue to capacitate the task teams, and in order for them to comply with the provisions of the Act and to perform in the way that they're performing the Forensic Science Laboratory, they rely on funds. And it's no secret that obviously our Forensic Science Laboratory, the DNA unit specifically, the consumables are more expensive than most. That is why a very detailed and a very comprehensive implementation plan was presented at length, I think for weeks on end, as I recall, to the Portfolio Committee at the time before this bill was finally passed. And in order for that implementation plan to be fulfilled, it relies on the budget that was allocated to it. And just recently, almost 650 million rand of that budget, which came from the CJS funds, has been taken away from the Forensic Science Laboratory. And this has catastrophic implications. The work of the Forensic Science Laboratory, if they are not supported in terms of their budget, if they cannot buy the consumables that they need to ensure that that laboratory is processing the number of samples that are being received and loading them onto the database, means that you are not going to get the results that I've just been showing you. but you are going to start creating backlogs that are not going to be overcome very easily. And we know from the past that backlogs in the forensic science laboratory have been a massive issue, and they really have worked a long way towards overcoming that. It also means, and I go back to the practical terms, that if we are not processing fast the convicted offender samplers or the reference samplers from the samples from the arrestees and linking them to cases or linking them to unknown profiles, then it means that those people are going to continue to commit crimes. Therefore, there are two options here. Either the funding in the baseline operational budget for next year has to be increased in order for the Forensic Science Laboratory to continue to do the work that they do, or the money that's been taken away from them in the CJS funding has to be reallocated back to them. If they are unable to buy their consumables, if they are unable to get the support staff that is necessary in order for them to function, the growth of the DNA database will stop and the backlogs will start to increase to the extent that they will probably never overcome them. And it is our responsibility to act now and to act fast to ensure that this doesn't occur. You can see in this particular slide that since the inception of the DNA Act, the number of cases that were registered and finalized has increased by 765% and 883% respectively. That is why we are able to convict somebody like McKee for 15 life sentences, because of the work that is being done. These kind of figures, if they do not have the budget to do what they need to do, or the resources to continue to do the work that they will do, will simply drop, and we will be back to 2010 when this bill first came before Parliament, and we will be starting all over again. They have only had a 4.4% increase in staff over the same period, and with two laboratories, this is also insufficient. They have no overtime budget. In order for that forensic science laboratory to operate, they need to work 24-hour shifts, and they're willing to do that. But people won't work without being paid for it. If they have the operation, I mean, if they have the overtime budget, which again has been taken away from them, they won't be able to keep up. This will negatively affect the ability of the forensic science laboratory to ensure compliance with the provisions of the Act. The DNA Act is very clear in terms of what has to be done. It's 30 days to get the sample to the laboratory. It's 30 days to analyze that sample unless there are compelling reasons that they cannot do so. Well, this is a compelling reason that it is our responsibility to bring before you and show you that they are not going to be able to comply with that unless they get the necessary infrastructure, resources, and budget to continue the great work that they've been doing. They've also got challenges with regards to the software. The service level agreement hasn't been signed between CETA and TMS, and it hampers their ability to load the profiles onto the database. They need to have systems that are integrated and ensure that at the end of the process those profiles are loaded. Without the profiles being on the database, they also cannot continue to make the hits that they've been making. So we're not sure whether that is within your mandate, but certainly CETA is delaying in terms of the overall national forensic DNA database solution software that they undertook to have ready within 4 years of the implementation of the Act. We are 3 years down the line and this still hasn't occurred. Another very simple but a very alarming problem is that buccal sample kits, because of the supply chain management budget and because of issues there, are not being supplied to stations. So you have a situation where Section 36D1, which, remember, wasn't made operational because they needed to ensure that enough police officers were trained to take buccal samples and that there's national representation. Well, the training has gone very well. There are almost 25,000 detectives that have been trained throughout South Africa, which actually is enough to operationalize Section 36D1 to make it mandatory. Currently, they're still working under the discretionary provision. But they can't operationalize it because they don't have buccal sample kits. Without the buccal sample kits with a reference sample, you've got no mechanism to link unknown cases to known cases. And this has to be addressed urgently because the officers have been trained, but without the tools to do their job, they are unable to perform the job that they're meant to do. Another very, very important issue, and this comes directly from the Divisional Commissioner of Protective Services and the Provincial Commissioners, is the task teams. I don't know if any of you will recall that at the time that the bill was promulgated, that it was very important as part of the standard operating procedures and the regulations and the transitional arrangements that task teams were allocated to ensure that when the National Forensic DNA Database Manager communicated the hits, which means that he's saying those cases are linked, you have a serial offender at hand, or that particular person is linked to that particular case, it means that the detective dealing with that case needs to follow up or communicate with the other cases that have been linked in order to ensure that the investigation progresses. Unfortunately, and here you will see in this slide, as of 30th of September 2017, these are the number of outstanding cases that haven't been followed up. For me, when I look at that, it represents a person's life. Because every single lead that hasn't been followed up means that that offender continues to walk our streets. And this is a methodology that no other form of forensic evidence has shown to be as effective as. A link on a DNA database is an absolute certainty that the person that you find, sample from the crime scene sample, if it matches that of a reference person or if they are linked, it is the same person. And here you have an amazing opportunity to link unrelated cases in different police stations, where in the past you could have the same person being tried in different courts and the investigating officers didn't even know they were dealing with a serial offender. We have to ensure that these task teams and these outstanding investigative leads are followed up. We can't be putting all of these other things in place, getting an operational budget, getting the convicted offenders sampling, getting our buckle kits into the stations, and then at the end of all of that, the task teams don't follow up on the needs. In terms of the subcommittees on the board, what we propose to do next year is to meet with the various provincial commissioners and in respect of each of the provinces, show them the numbers, look at the cases, and follow it up from that side. But obviously in terms of intervention, if there can be some pressure to bear on the provisional commissioners from the portfolio committee's perspective, it would obviously be a great help in ensuring, and they may not even be aware of this wonderful tool that's just simply not being followed up. So in concluding our presentation today, a number of the interventions that would support the work that we do and support that of the Forensic Science Laboratory is to assist with the urgent processing of the DNA Amendment Act to ensure that the sampling of convicted offender program is continued without delay. To support the reactivation of the CJS funding to underpin the Forensic Science Laboratory's efforts to comply with the DNA Act to ensure optimal performance of the NFDD. And we can see how the NFDD, the National DNA Database, has solved so many cases. I don't think there's a day that I don't read a newspaper where there's a link with DNA evidence to a particular person. And if that's not possible, to ensure that SAPS increases the baseline operational budget to the Division of the Forensic Services to ensure that they are able to purchase the consumables and have the staff that is necessary to enable them to continue with those percentages, over 700-800% performance rates going forward. To ensure that the Division of the Supply Chain Management must take immediate measures to ensure buccal sample kits are procured and distributed to all stations. There cannot be a single station that doesn't have a supply of buccal samples. Those police officers are trained. You can walk into a police station and you can say, has anybody been trained in buccal sampling? They will say yes. but they don't have the tools to do it, which means that people who have been arrested walk away without their DNA samples being taken. To prevail upon the provincial commissioners to activate the task teams to ensure that investigative leads are followed up, this has to be continued. Those numbers represent people's lives, and unless they follow up on those cases, it means that those cases remain unsolved. And to prevail upon CETA to complete the NFDD solution software and the NFOB IT infrastructure so that we can have effective operations both at the level of the forensic DNA database and at the level of the board. I thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Ms. Lynch, for your presentation. I think we note the contents of it. But members, if there's any urgent follow-ups, any members welcome. Honourable Bailey.
Thank you, Chair. I will keep it short. I'm aware of the time constraints. excuse me. But I think, I mean, the one comment is to say that so many of these challenges are, again, about SAPS management just getting the basics right. The drum we bang at this committee all the time. I mean, supply chain management, no rocket science there. It continues to be mind-boggling, especially given the urgency of the matter and the immense value it can add if we get this right. As per the examples given in the presentation. But just two very quick questions, Chair. The first one is in terms of, I forget what page it was now, but where the indication was given by National Treasury, page 14, the determination that the 650 million rand, which is, as I understand, about recurring costs, would no longer form part of the CJS funds. When was that indication given? Oh, hang on, I think I just saw my answer, August 2017. If I could just get confirmation if that was the case, August 2017. But I guess the key question I have is around this big concern that there are convicted offenders being released before they've been sampled. Because the two-year window has expired. Is there still no way or no reason why we can't at least sample the offenders as they get released? And then to prioritize the ones who are part of the intake at the... So, I mean, I understand there's a big mass of unsampled offenders in the correctional services system, and that will take a long time. But certainly at the intake and the exit points, just to prioritize those, because if somebody is being released on parole or because their sentence is served, we at least need to catch them if they are linked on the database before they disappear into the ether. Is there any way to get that done and to have that discussion with SAPS and the DCS? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mulabatsi, and then Honourable Kola Barnard. Honourable Kola Barnard, you can go ahead, thank you.
Chair, this is just so incredibly frustrating to hear when I think how we worked on this bill, and to see that you suffer with this myriad problems, that their task teams are not following up on leads. It's handed to them on a plate, and they're not doing what they need to do. Thousands of cases looks like just not being solved because they're not doing it. I don't know that we've ever had a satisfactory explanation in terms of the budget cuts that you referred to and that Honourable Bogdell referred to. It shouldn't be up to you, I don't think, to, and I quote, prevail upon provincial commissioners to activate task teams to follow these leads. That's surely not your job. You shouldn't have to prevail upon anyone. They should just do their work. I could bang my head against the wall. I'm just so frustrated for you. It really is that you are now handing SAPS members this perfect tool, and it's not being used. It's not being utilized adequately. You say there's a shortage of buccal sample kits. They've got an 87 watt billion rand budget, and it's like saying there are no rape kits at the stations. That, to me, is the equivalent. So I think this will have to be taken up at the highest possible levels to help you out. Thank you. It's a very thorough and honest report. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Bernard. Honourable Mulabatsi.
Thank you, Chair. About the buccal samples, are all officers trained on this, or do you have designated ones? Thank you.
Any other members? Everybody covered. Thank you. Let's get the final responses. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. In response to the first questions that were raised, the indication, I haven't got the exact date on me now, I can look, but I can certainly send it to you, the exact date. It was approximately a month ago, and it was reallocated to the Department of Home Affairs biometric program. The biometrics. Oh, here? Did you find it? Did you say? Yes. Oh, and no, in terms of when this was reallocated, that was about a month ago. We were notified of this. So that was why it's either to reallocate it or increase the baseline operational budget for next year. And they have put it in their request. In terms of CEOs, and you can imagine that specifically myself, I have looked and have recommended every possible solution to sampling convicted offenders. And a recommendation was Section 36E1, which was a discretionary provision that says in the event that somebody may have been suspected of committing a Schedule 8 offence, that they could be sampled. Unfortunately, because of the specifics of convicted offender sampling retrospectively, unless you have a specific case where you think that they may have been involved in, they can't just do it on a sort of on an arbitrary basis. So if they do have a specific case where they think a convicted offender has been linked to, then they have the authority to do that in terms of that act. Incoming would have had their samples taken at the time of arrest currently, so they are covered, and then it gets migrated to the convicted offender program. But outgoing, the only way if this is, on parole, that still falls under the convicted offender index. So only if this is passed quite urgently, they can go back to all those people on parole and they can sample them. But if they're outside of their levels of parole. So that's the answer in terms of that. In terms of prevailing upon the provincial commissioners, whilst it may not be a particular mandate of ours, I do think, and we have recognized that often at that level they are unaware of what's happening at grassroots level. And because of the nature of our work and the fact that we actually ensure that at grassroots level we get stuck down and say what's happening at the level that, why don't these numbers match, then certainly if we can assist on that basis, it often does help. And then in terms of buccal samples, currently they targeted detectives, but detectives are also very overburdened in terms of their time, so then they started to increase that to visible policing. And in fact what they're doing is that they are sending the visible police into DCS, or they were sending them into the convicted offender, into the prisons to sample them. But yes, the representation is, as I said, is currently around 25,000 nationally. And you're going to find at least one person per station to be able to sample. But at least one. I'm not saying that there are obviously a lot more per station. But in terms of if we were to operationalize Section 36D1, we could do so on the basis of representation. But in terms of the resources, both at the laboratory and at the stations, they don't feel they're in a position to do that for that recommendation. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much.
A quick one in addition to what Vanessa has said regarding catching those inmates prior to release in getting their samples taken. The elephant in the room with inmates is usually those who refuse their samples. And if we look at the proposed amendment, it deals particularly with that.
And if we can get that amendment on board, we'll be able to deal with a great number of inmates getting out there without their suffering on the NLF duty.
Thank you very much, Judge. Mr. Rogers, anything from your side? Maybe just Advocate Bell, I just want to get an indication in terms of the Amendment Act, timelines, when will it be submitted to Parliament?
At this stage, it's difficult to say because I'm not sure when Parliament resumes next year, and we still have to see the JCPS DG's cluster. And I think their last meeting is on the 5th of December. So depending on what comes out of tomorrow's meeting at DEVCOM, we will know whether or not they're going to go through to the DGs. And once we go to the DGs and they allow us through, then it will go to the CAB committee. And then the CAB committee will allow us to publish it, comment. And it's got to be published for at least a month for public comment, and then we have to go back that same route again to get back to cabinet. So we are hoping that by March we ought to have presented at cabinet.
Right, yeah, I think there should be a shorter process because it's got severe implications for the criminal justice system if this gap continues unabated. So I think Portfolio Committee, I mean, we will deal with it, but I mean, it's important that the Secretariat gives urgent attention to the matter. Then in terms of the issues raised in the presentation, there's serious, I think, operational issues from SAP side. We will take it up, I think, tomorrow and on Friday, also with the new National Commissioner, to address it as a matter of urgency. It's quite important. And then, of course, we will arrange in February for the official briefing on the annual report. So thank you very much for attending. Members, just to remind you, tomorrow 9 o'clock and Friday 9 o'clock. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you so much, Chairman. And once more, our apologies. Sorry about that.